This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Army interrogator Tony Lagaranis arrived at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison in the spring of 2004, just after allegations of prisoner abuse by American guards began to surface. And while Lagaranis was not involved in any of the infamous pictures of Abu Ghraib, he did many things out of sight that give him nightmares to this day. He used military dogs, sleep deprivation, stress positions, and, in one case, a mock execution to get Iraqi prisoners to confess. He wonders what the experience did to them, what it did to him, and whether it was worth it. Now, nearly 2 years after an honorable discharge, Tony Lagaranis has written a book about his experiences at Abu Ghraib and other prisons in Iraq. Later on in the program, Joe Queenan explores an inconvenient truth, the fact that, as he puts it, documentary movies suck. And, of course, the roller coaster ride to hell. But first, an Army interrogator's story. If you have questions for Tony Lagaranis about his experiences in Iraq, or if you have experience as an interrogator with the military or the police, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Tony Lagaranis' book is called Fear Up Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq. He joins us today from our bureau in Chicago. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And the title, Fear Up Harsh, what does that mean?
Fear Up Harsh is an interrogation tactic. It's one that we learned in the schoolhouse. And as far as I know, it's consistent with Geneva Conventions. It really just involves intimidating the prisoner through raising your voice, pounding your fist on the table maybe throwing a chair across the room. But it doesn't involve a threat, either implied or explicit, toward the prisoner.
Throwing a chair across the room is not an implied threat?
Well, you can't indicate to him that he's going to suffer any harm as a consequence of not answering your questions. The purpose of Fear Up Harsh is maybe to, you know, plant things in his mind that you aren't explicitly telling him is going to happen.
Now, when you say the schoolroom, this is Fort Huachuca in Arizona.
Correct. That's where we did the basic interrogation course right after basic training.
And what led you? Did you apply to become an interrogator? Did you want to do this, or is this something you were sort of drafted into?
I wasn't drafted into it. I chose it. I walked into the recruiter's office and asked for Arabic. I wanted to learn Arabic. There were two jobs I could get. One required a top secret clearance. The other required secret. I had too many student loans to get the top secret, so they gave me secret, which is interrogator.
Mm-hmm. So, but when you got this assignment, you said, interesting.
Well, I didn't really think about it much. I wanted to learn Arabic, and the idea that I would actually interrogate somebody seemed remote. But I thought that if I did interrogate somebody, it would be in accordance with Geneva Conventions. I didn't think that there would be moral issues attached to it.
And that's what they taught you at Fort Huachuca.
Yes, they told us that everyone we would interrogate, and it didn't matter who the detainee was and what his legal status was, we would treat them as though they were enemy prisoners of war.
And that meant complying with the Geneva Conventions.
Correct.
And that gives you fairly, after all of these years of interpretation, the rules when you're talking about Geneva, they're pretty clear-cut.
They're very clear-cut. Yeah, there's a very clear line over which you cannot cross. And that doesn't mean that the interrogator doesn't have a lot of tools at his toolkit. It just means that, you know, getting aggressive and violent and cruel, that's not among them.
And so what happened when you took this training and you were then sent to Iraq?
Well, we went to Iraq and we were told that Geneva Conventions didn't apply to the detainees that we had.
Who told you
that?
There.
We saw an interrogation rules of engagement. It included things like using stress positions. I don't remember exactly what was on the one at Abu Ghraib, but particularly I remember the one that we saw in Mosul, and it included using dogs. It included isolation, sleep deprivation, environmental manipulation, which we took to mean inducing hypothermia. Now, clearly these things violated Geneva Conventions, so we asked our leaders about it. They told us that this was legal, rules of engagement was legal because Geneva didn't apply to the detainees in Iraq.
And were the rules clear, did you think?
No. I mean, some of them sound very clear, like particularly the use of dogs was very clear that, you know, they had to be muzzled, they had to be restrained. But in a way, it was sort of open-ended. Like, what does environmental manipulation mean exactly? We took it to mean you could induce hypothermia or intense heat.
Or intense cold.
Yeah, that's what I mean in inducing hypothermia.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it could mean many things, and, you know, who knows what you could use it for. And then also, you know, the document said clearly that the interrogator needs the room to be creative. These rules should only be a guideline. These are not restrictive. They're, these are suggestions. So in a way, it was open-ended.
And when you started to use the rules creatively, how did you respond to that?
Well, we actually didn't get terribly creative. We stuck to the document because we were worried about crossing lines. Mm-hmm. And we were being told by the chief warrant officer up there what he wanted us to do. For instance, the dogs, or we organized a shipping container where we would use strobe lights and loud music to not only keep him awake at night, but also to disorient him. We were keeping him outside in the rain to induce the hypothermia. So we were keeping strictly to what we were told to do and what we felt was legal according to the document. And we felt curious of whether or not these things would work. I mean, certainly we wanted intelligence, and we weren't getting very good intelligence, in our interrogation. So we were eager to try these methods, but we were certainly worried about them on both, a moral level as well as a legal mm-hmm. level.
And did they work?
No, they never worked.
People wouldn't tell you things?
No. In fact, I think that, I think that it really just sort of strengthened their resolve to not tell us. People only tell you things in interrogation if they want to. That's your job in interrogation, is to try and get them to want to tell you things. No one's going to want to tell you things if you're humiliating them and causing them duress and if you're being cruel.
And this was all being done as, you know, the scandal of Abu Ghraib was coming out. You would think that, did anybody then tell, guys, we got to scale it back? We got to be careful here?
As soon as the scandal broke, which was in mid-April, that was just about the time that we were, really using the most harsh tactics that we used up there in Mosul. As soon as the scandal broke, we weren't allowed to use the dogs anymore, and slowly just everything just started getting pulled away, and we didn't do any of that stuff anymore, which was fine with us because we had already determined we didn't want to anyway, and it wasn't producing intelligence.
Let's see if we get some listeners involved in this conversation. We're talking today with Tony Lagaranis. He's a former Army interrogator in Iraq, author of Fear Up Harsh. 800-989-8255 is our telephone number, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's go to John. John's with us from Iowa City.
Hi. Hello, sir. I was calling to ask if you felt there was any leeway or a chance for a soldier to say no if they've been asked to do these things that all of us that have gone through the Army have been taught about, the Geneva Conventions and the laws of torture. So did you feel like there was any way to be a conscientious objector in that way, or to say no, and what might happen if you did?
Well, that's certainly what I should have done, because once they told us that Geneva didn't apply, then we were in an area where we didn't have training for this anymore, and we didn't know what the legality was. You're always told in the Army that you can refuse to follow an order if it's unlawful, and that's your duty to refuse to follow that order. But since we were in a gray area, we didn't know what to do, and we should have simply refused until it could have been clarified by a JAG officer.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask one more question?
Sure, go ahead.
I almost lost it. Well, since torture has been, these concepts that they've used for torture have been around for an extremely long time, I don't think any of them are really new. They're all covered by a Geneva Convention as to the way you can act to to anyone being picked up as, someone being held. Is the whole idea of the enemy combatant thing, is that what messes it up? Or
mm-hmm. That these are not prisoners of war, but enemy combatants? Is that the distinction that turned out to be important to Tony Lagaranis?
Well, I'm not sure, because we were only trained, I haven't studied Geneva Conventions. We were only trained to deal with enemy prisoners of war. And even if we were interrogating an insurgent, we would have dealt with them as though they were an enemy prisoner of war. So I don't have training. Enemy combatant, I don't think that exists in Geneva Conventions. I think that's something that the administration invented in order to further muddy the waters so that
certainly
people didn't know.
Yes.
Right. Thanks very much for the call,
Thank
John.
Thank you.
And let's see if we can get another voice on who might be able to help us with this. Darius Rajali joins us. He's a professor of political science at Reed College, who's written extensively about interrogation and torture. And he joins us today from the studios of member station KQED, our member station in San Francisco. And it's nice to have you on the program today.
Yes, it's nice to be here.
And this distinction between prisoners of war and enemy combatants, does it exist in the Geneva Convention? And is that what messed things up, that lack of distinction in Iraq?
Not as far as I remember. It's not in the convention. And basically, the term has never been adequately defined by the Bush administration. I mean, you have people classified as enemy combatants in Guantanamo who were sitting in Taliban jails. So hard to know what that means. Basically, it's all what Tony says is quite right, is that to get people to do violence of the sort that he's talking about, you basically need unclear rules, no punishment for which set of rules you follow, no regular medical inspections, and no public review of a person's status, which is what the conventions require. And once you have that, ordinary people will start acting violently towards others, particularly if you add a bit of ethnic hatred in the mix, mm-hmm. and some fear of imminent danger. That'll do it for you. And it doesn't matter whether you were trained, as the last caller said, to resist unlawful orders or to say no to them. Pretty much what the experiments show is that you can trump moral behavior by creating conditions like this.
When we get back from a break, we're going to talk to Tony Lagaranis and with Darius Rajali about the conditions that lead people trained to behave in a moral fashion to behave in what they believe to be a violation of their most deeply held beliefs. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Tony Lagaranis about the things he did and witnessed as an army interrogator in Iraq. He tells the story of his time at Abu Ghraib and other prisons in the book Fear Up Harsh. To read more about why he feels his work in Iraq neither provided intelligence nor saved lives, stop by at our website, npr.org/talk, where we've posted an excerpt from the book. Also with us is Darius Rajali, who's written widely about interrogation and torture. And if you have experience as an interrogator with the military or the police, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And we'll also take your questions for Tony Lagaranis about his experiences at Abu Ghraib and other Iraqi prisons through our blog. That's at npr.org/blog of the nation, all one word. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Dave. Dave with us from Rochester in Massachusetts.
Yes. I was trained as an interrogator back in Vietnam, and we interrogated a lot of VC, a lot of NVA, always with respect, never taught to do anything else. And I just wondered how it disintegrated to that and why, in the end, nobody above the rank of sergeant seemed to pay the price.
Tony Lagaranis, what do you think?
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because there seems to be a popular belief that in Vietnam, American soldiers were torturing people regularly and that they were successful in getting information through torture, which is, I don't know where the source material is for this. I think it's from movies. But
I can tell you it didn't happen in the 1st Air Cavalry Division.
Well, thank you. Thank you for telling us that. But, you know, in the real a big difference in Vietnam was that the leadership was not pushing for torture. The leadership said no. When torture did occur, and I'm sure it did, I'm sure it occurred in every conflict that ever happened in the world. But when it did happen in Vietnam, it was illegal, and it was clear that it was illegal. Right now, we have the senior leaders, the senior civilian leadership, trying to put this into policy, and that's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And give us some historical perspective, if you would, Darius Rajali.
Yeah, sure. In fact, the studies of the U.S. military of Vietnam interrogation said that 90% of cases, people gave information exactly as you said, without coercive interrogation whatsoever. There are reports, and there was a subculture of that did do certain kinds of coercive techniques. It was not tolerated. but it existed. And I think the big thing I take from Tony's book here just is that, you know, what happens over there comes back over here. I mean, one of the things that happened in Chicago, as Tony knows, is that there is a carryover from people who did that kind of interrogation, the coercive interrogation. When they came back, they became cops, and techniques spilled over. So, you know, that stuff, if it happens, if it's tolerated, then it can sneak back onto the mainland.
Thanks very much for the call, Dave.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And let me ask you, Tony Lagaranis, there's a part of your book and part of your experience which I know is difficult for you to talk about, but you write that you could see the fear in the men's eyes, you could smell it, you could hear it, you could almost taste it.
Right, and I think that was more the purpose of the torture, was to experience that kind of domination, because we felt very afraid. We felt really victimized daily because we were being mortared all the time. We never had an opportunity to actually engage the enemy. We were simply being shot at. And you add to that we went into interrogations with men that we often knew nothing about. Sometimes they were high-level Ba'athists, and we felt that they could see how inexperienced and green we were. Mm-hmm. And we wanted that sense of domination over them. And that was the purpose of the torture. It wasn't necessarily intelligence gathering.
And you also wrote that you enjoyed it.
Well, I think a certain part of me enjoyed it, yeah. But I want to be clear. I said that because I was trying to be as honest as I could be with myself and the reader. I see it as when people learn that I was an interrogator, they are fascinated. They're darkly fascinated by it. Why do people tune into 24 every week? Hmm. Why are people so enthusiastic to engage in this debate on the pro torture side? It's because people they want that, because they're afraid and they're angry and they want to see that domination.
An email question from Michael in Portland, Oregon. Your guest keeps using the term "we." Was trepidation universal among his fellow interrogators?
Yeah, I think so. Let me understand the question. I think he means that...
I think he was talking about the trepidation over the use of these techniques that you weren't trained in.
Well, of course, everyone was a little bit afraid, at least of the legality, and we were certainly walking in a moral landscape which we were unfamiliar with, so I'm sure there was trepidation. But let me add to that there was also enthusiasm from everyone. No one ever refused to do these things. And there was enthusiasm from people who had no business being interrogators. They wanted to come in and participate. The MPs wanted to participate. Soldiers simply walking by the facility would want to come and participate. And I don't mean simply in interrogation. I mean in torture.
Mm-hmm. Because they saw this as the best way to find intelligence they could act on, or because it was revenge?
No, it was revenge. They were acting on fear and anger. They didn't even know who the detainee was we had in there, or what intelligence we could hope to gain from them, if there was any.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to, I guess it's Darius Rajali, getting back to the point. Well, here's an email question, and let me ask first Tony to respond to it, and then you first. Would he, Tony, feel differently about the morality of more extreme measures if they had been effective? And second of all, would real physical torture be acceptable if it actually produced results, a la the French in Algeria? So let me ask the first part to you, Tony Lagaranis. If you'd gotten real actionable intelligence, would you have felt better?
I think it would have taken me longer to feel bad. I mean, I think the first real problem I had was when I realized that we were using these techniques on people who not only didn't have information, but probably were innocent of anything we were accusing them of. But as a moral principle, I think it stands. And these things are the efficacy I really talk about, because people want to talk about that when you talk mm-hmm. about a torture debate. But, you know, I stand firm that the most important reason not to torture is a moral reason.
Mm. And that second part of the question to you, Darius Rajali.
Well, I mean, I think people should stop watching The Battle of Algiers, the movie, and start reading some history. Actually, the movie gives the false impression that torture actually produced effects regularly. But I just spent a goodly part of my last 10 years going through a lot of this material in French. And a lot of the former French soldiers, not the captains, but the people like Tony, have now reached the age of 60, and they're now writing their stories. It's pretty clear that their stories are identical to Tony's. I mean, let's get the facts of The Battle of Algiers clear. clear, there were 24,000 arrest warrants that were issued out just for civilian arrest warrants. That doesn't include the military people, the military arrests. 3,024 people disappeared. There was a total of, in the Kasbah, 1,400 FLN supporters and their the guerrillas. So even if every one of them was caught under the 3,024, you were basically torturing vast numbers of people, 20 people, 30 people, maybe, for one accurate hit. And that actually isn't entirely, and that's a good figure, because a lot of these guys either died in battles or turned double agents. In fact, most of the information in the Battle of Algiers came through very deadly informants, none of whom appear in the Battle of Algiers. Urhia the Brown, for example, a jilted woman of an FLN fighter, walked right into French authorities and handed people over. She was deadly.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Steve. Steve with us from Arizona.
Yes, I'm a 26-year interrogator, actually still in the military. I'm on a mission now, stateside, two deployments, heading for another deployment not too long. Served mostly in interrogation, human intelligence collection roles, and everybody has a different type of war experience, but in my 26 years, I've never been encouraged in any way to use coercive techniques, and if anything, it's been the opposite. I remember, in fact, in one of the prisoner of war camps, a general flying in a helicopter and saying he was going to close down the camps because of the deplorable conditions. At the time, we'd surrendered our tents to the prisoners of war so that they wouldn't be as cold. They were eating hot chow. We were eating cold chow. And my experience has been that, again, I haven't been – I felt the pressure to produce, but I've never been in a situation where I've interpreted or anyone has indicated to me that that would mean for me to use coercive techniques. And as far as technically, I would agree. I don't believe they work. My skill set, and I think every interrogator is different. You can't say that each interrogator is can use – a set of techniques. They're going to use the set of techniques that work for them. But mine is I befriend the source, and I'm very, very good at that, and I collected a lot of information that was very useful. I can't even imagine using, frankly, I was never good at fear up, harsh or otherwise. And but my 26 years, to hear these things is, to me, deplorable. And I feel very fortunate that I was never put in a position where I felt compelled to do those things, even though I'm quite certain I wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. And
I'm a warrant officer, and and that's my attitude. I'm not going to do what somebody tells me just because they told me to do it.
You had more experience, I think, than Tony Lagaranis had when he went to Iraq. And I assume when you said you'd served a couple of tours, you meant in Iraq.
That's correct.
And Afghanistan as well?
I have not. That's actually going to be my next tour, I assume.
And it must be difficult to, in an army where things are, let's not to put too fine a point on it, standardized to a point of obsession. It is, isn't it unusual, Steve, that your instructions and what Tony was being told and his when he was based there were such wildly different things?
Well, I don't know. I'm sorry I didn't catch the entire show. I don't think it would be unusual that he might get different instructions in a different operation. If he received instruction in a standardized course...
Now, he said the standardized course was very much emphasizing the Geneva Convention. It's when he got to Abu Ghraib when things changed.
Right, Abu Ghraib. And I didn't serve at Abu Ghraib, although I had some interaction with Abu Ghraib. Where I did serve in Iraq, I was not. I didn't run into that, and it was fortunate. I actually did get involved early on with the Abu Ghraib situation, mainly because somebody that I was working with was from CID, and I saw the pictures early on. I found them deplorable, shocking... And I was a bit surprised, actually, even though it's not necessarily the interrogators per se. It was disappointing to me. I was a very strong supporter of Senator McCain and his anti-torture legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I have always been strong that way is I don't want to be given the choice. I don't want to ever feel that I have the choice to use those techniques. And again, it's just a matter of, you know, you can have many people deployed to the same war. I never faced a situation where I felt compelled to use those. If anything, it was the opposite, and I'm grateful for that. But I don't think any interrogator should face a situation where they feel that that is even an option.
Mm-hmm. And I wondered, Darius Rajali, to ask you to add in on that, the accounts you've given of people other than Tony who've come back from their experiences as interrogators and said, wait a minute, this was awful.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There's a... Actually, whenever a military sets up two standards where you get two sets of messages, you guys torture, you guys can't, there's a spillover effect. There's kind of a slippery slope as more and more people get sucked into the other process. The Brazilians had a huge problem with this. And it basically broke down military discipline when the professionals and the torturers basically had to face each other. And eventually, the Brazilians started shooting at the torturers just to keep the military discipline intact. And, you know, one of the problems with the Military Commissions Act is it sets up two parallel systems of interrogation, one for enhanced interrogation and one for the military, which can't. And this is going to be a problem. In the long run, what happens in all of these situations is that you get people coming back. We have studies of the Greek torturers. We have studies of the Brazilian torturers now. And they basically come back, quite a few of them, because they're stuck between sort of democratic norms, one set of rules, and what they're being asked to do. Many of them develop perpetrator-induced traumatic stress, which for all intents and purposes is a lot like post-traumatic stress, except it's driven by guilt rather than by actual violence. And many others suffer burnout and stress. It differs a lot. I mean, basically, the Brazilians tell us, those who were involved in death squads basically say that they much preferred their jobs to torturers. Torturers actually wanted to become members of death squads because they don't have to take their work home with them. You know, they shoot the guy and they go. Whereas the torturers' work, the interrogators' work, that's never done. And, of course, the rank-and-file people don't develop PTSD. They do perfectly fine lives. It's the lower downs who develop the burnout stress effects.
Steve? I think one of the things, just from my perspective, is to take a positive approach, too. And interrogators need to see positive approaches working. We were one of the most productive teams in our area of operation, and we were known for befriending. And I'm not saying this can always work. It can work for every interrogator. It depends on their personality. But we were out in the camp eating with the prisoners, befriending them, and we used very different techniques. And a lot of the guards that were watching us, the military police, thought it strange when we're walking around holding hands with prisoners in the in the area. But we were very rigorous in doing it, and we found those friends. And these are people that, when released from the camp, actually found us and started to act as sources for us. So not only were they productive while we were in the camp, but afterwards, they continue to, because of that friendship and that relationship that was developed, they continue to give us information.
Steve, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about interrogators in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email from Stephen in Indiana. Something that always bothers me about these discussions is we focus on the techniques of getting somebody to talk, but how does the interrogator know the person being interrogated has something to say, given the odd ways in which persons have been caught up in this web? Isn't it especially problematic? You can't get blood from a stone. And Tony Lagaranis, that seemed to be part of your problem. You keep saying a lot of these people, I didn't even know why they were picked up.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, even if they had information, we as interrogators need to know something about them in order to know what to go for. I mean, I remember I got one detainee, and the only thing that he had on his paperwork was that he was on a blacklist. So I call up the analyst and I say, why is he on this blacklist? They had no idea. They just said, go fishing. Like, go into the interrogation booth and go fishing. What are you supposed to do in that case? I mean, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing was so common. We had people in front of us that weren't even being accused of having done anything, much less they did it.
And there's no amount of training that can get you ready for that.
No. And I wish we had had more. As the caller Steve said, you know, we as interrogators needed to see approaches working. We spent about one day on approaches. And, you know, the softer approaches have, you know, these ridiculous names like love of comrades, love of family, love of country. You can't really imagine those things working in an interrogation. They do work. They do work in the hands of a good interrogator, but they're just not that simple. They involve, like, a whole series of building, of relationship building. But we never saw it work. And I wanted to ask the caller before he hung up if he actually still performs interrogations. Because in my experience, the more experienced interrogators, even those on just their second tour, became administrators, and you had young privates going into the interrogation booth.
Tony Lagaranis, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Tony Lagaranis, a former Army interrogator. His book is Fear Up Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq. Darius Rajali, professor of political science at Reed College, joined us today from KQED in San Francisco. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And when we come back, Joe Queenan says, movie documentaries make him sick. 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.